Thanks a lot. I'll be introducing the next speaker here, which is Donald Charles Cole. And he's a trained physician, and he has practiced primary care, public health, occupational health, and environmental health in a variety of settings in Canada and lower and middle income countries. He has worked with a lot of different organizations. Just to mention a few, the International Potato Center, and he's now the interim head of the Global Health Division at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health, University of Toronto. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, and it really is good to be here to talk about environmental health and equity, two very important things, certainly in my life, and I think for many of our well-being. It's a pretty overwhelming task to be asked to talk about food security, environmental health, and equity all in about 15 minutes. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to talk about briefly some key points around global issues and responses, but then also have a sort of a track all the way through around Hortasana. And Hortasana is a project we've had going with CETA and IDRC funding in Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador in the Andean region. And Horta is for horticulture, so vegetable production, and Sana is healthy. And I think it's a sort of it's one lens, and it's one where we've tried to think through some of the issues about food security, environmental health, and equity, in as we try to, we sort of say nudge, shift, transform. Transform might be in the grant proposal, but when you actually review the results, nudge is probably a better term in terms of actually moving and making change. The photographs here are of two farmers. The one on the left is in Pijaro. She's part of a women's association of farmers, Santa Catalina. And the woman on the right is a farmer in the another Andean valley, the Mantaro Valley near Huancayo in Peru. And these are truly our partners, and as we discover and try to nudge these horticultural systems. So, busy slides, but I just thought I'll do fewer slides, and you can just sort of look at them quite a while. Okay? So, issues globally, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through access to land, water, and then inputs, markets, and governance. It's a fairly broad way of taking it, but I think it's all those things are important as we think about food systems. So access to land is one of the first things, and we've heard about it on and off here. Particularly we heard it from David Satterthwaite. And historically in low and middle income countries, inequitable land ownership has been on the agenda for centuries, and particularly for women. In work we did in Kampala in East Africa, we found that smallholders in urban and peri-urban areas producing food often did not have enough land to either support their households or buffer the effects of reduced assets. In other words, household assets, the lower you tend to go, the worse is household food security. So if they had enough land, that line, instead of being sort of that kind of relationship, you could actually flatten it. So for lower assets, other kinds of assets, they could still have food security in the household. And so if you get too little land for a household, it's very hard to maintain that. So globally, there's been certainly reforms, and I give you one example. There's a long agenda of land reform in Africa. And I think actually the Food and Agriculture Organization's recent annual report on the role of women in agriculture and the gender gap for development is really quite well done and certainly deals with access to land as well as lots of other things that are relevant for women farmers. In the Andes, when we asked farm households, about 250 farm households in the Huancayo region, about their actual, you know, what relationship did they have that land, 35% of them said they don't have any formal title. It's just been passed on through their families. And that's partly communal traditions in indigenous groups, the Quechua and others. That is the way they dealt with land. And so partly as they've moved into a more household-based ownership, there hasn't been necessarily formal title processes around that. That's not so bad when you're in a very rural area, but when you start moving into when the urban development starts encroaching on your area and other kinds of uses for commercial, for factory, for other kinds of purposes start being foisted upon you in some ways, then the lack of clear deed is a real challenge for peri-urban farmers. The other thing that happens is as the sort of the city moves out, and you know, have in your mind sort of these valleys where urban development is increasing, and then people get drawn into that urban economy and they're less and less engaged with the land, and the land itself, even though they have access to it, is not as well taken care of. So some work that colleagues have done in the Lima region in peri-urban agriculture is bringing agriculture very much into the urban development planning paradigm. The other thing that we did in the Hortisana project was basically a message around maintaining access to land, but also land fertility. Because if you can maintain land fertility, people will still keep using the land, and it won't be seen as wasteland or unoccupied land, etc. And it will be still seen as valuable and maintained in food production. You've heard lots about water this morning. So maybe I can pick up a few things on the issue. One that perhaps hasn't been talked about as much is mining contamination. So if we look at the Huancayo region, big mines, there's been a history of gold mining and other mining in Latin America, particularly in the Andes. And historically, these mines and their attached smelters grossly polluted the landscape, destroyed huge swaths of trees, of livestock herds, of farming areas, made them virtually uninhabitable. And then as you take the watersheds of those mines, where further down farmers are actually trying to work with the water, they have high metal levels. They have they're often very acid. They're not good for farming. And so certainly in the Montero Valley region, that has been something that the Catholic Church and other NGOs have been fighting for decent containment, and there certainly have been some improvements of the mine discharges. The other thing people mentioned, though, is, and I think about some of the discussion yesterday about people being conscious of a resource and then thinking about what they can do themselves. So a lot of farmers complained about people just washing their clothes in the irrigation channels, and so that the farmers further down ended up with lots of soap residues and all kinds of other things, which are also not good for farming. Other people talked about dumping of farm waste, dung, dead animals. So these are clearly practices that could change if there was a... And it's funny because there are juntas de riego or water resource irrigation management groups, and they're expected to take responsibility for many of these things. But like many community-based organizations, they struggle with adequate training. adequate resources to carry out the various things that they would like to do, as well as sort of the commons kind of challenge in terms of making more conscious their neighbors about preserving the resource. Absolute scarcity of water is a big issue, particularly in Huancayo, Montara Valley, but it also, with climate change, is a thing that's increasing in other parts of the Andes, that the rains that were expected to come in Tungurahua and Pijaro area, they just didn't come for several months at a time, which puts everybody's agricultural cycle off. And farmers lose a kind of regular certainty about when to plant. And maybe they plant and then things dry up and they lose their investment. It creates real havoc for farmers. So climate change is a real issue. Some of the responses in this region is colleagues are very involved in community-based water harvesting, basically digging holes, lining them with plastic, and that being a source to capture the massive water flows that come with the rains that are due partly to deforestation but are partly due to the changes in the water cycle that a colleague was talking about yesterday. Reforestation is very important, and so is microirrigation. The next big area is appropriate inputs. And a lot of development projects work on providing external inputs. Fertilizer's the classic. Pesticides are very common. Although there are certain, those are certainly important in some areas where soil is depleted, etc., they lead farmers into a dependency on external outputs or inputs. And because they're not returning and taking care of the land in a way, they also lead to reduced environmental sustainability and eventually declining productivity. So one of the books I shared with the Institute colleagues here was by Steve Sherwood, who did his doctorate at the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands, and talked about modernization as a process of decline for smallholders in the Andes. And I think that is something we often lose sight of, that in fact the very marketization and process of intensive energy and external input, intensive agriculture, in fact can lead to greater vulnerability for both farmers and the environment. And this is really raised in the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, an expert group that was convened and put together a really very sound report on where do we actually need to be going in terms of agricultural science and technology. Similarly, the World Watch Institute, this isn't a plug only for my colleague from the World Watch Institute, the innovations that nourish the planet in terms of other ways, other socio-technical regimes for agriculture, is really filled with innovative ways of dealing with it, alternative designs for agriculture. A brief example of one of the things we did as a group was these BEALs, which are basically liquid fertilizers that producers can produce themselves from manure and other local ingredients, and they increase productivity, they increase soil fertility. The other, so that's the bottle and sort of bucket on your on the left. And on the right is a group of women farmers in the Pijaro region who have put together their own composting facility. So they get organic waste from the local urban markets, from farmers, and they put it together with soil and usually a bit of, a bit of a starter. There's a bunch of projects with a local agricultural university working on ways of improving that compost. They're selling that compost. They're using it in their gardens. It's a very locally produced and appropriate input that they can use both for their own livelihoods and for their own production. I was charged with taking on the bads as well, and hazardous pesticides, more specifically, categories 1A and B, or category 2 moderate, using the WHO classification based on acute toxicity. And globally, there's a huge trade in hazardous pesticides. Lots of multinationals based in both high-income countries that produce the technical ingredients, but also medium-income countries, and then formulation in low-income countries. Because they're off patent, they're usually way cheaper. So we find that the poorest farmers use the most hazardous pesticides. Most smallholders know these things are dangerous. They don't have the personal protective equipment to work with them. Example of some teenage farm laborers in Carchi in Ecuador. And they get most of their advice as to what to do with things from pesticide salespeople. We've shown this in World Bank-funded surveys in Peru, as well as our own surveys in Ecuador. What this means is that there are neurotoxic health impacts on farmers and their households, their kids, which if you do econometric modeling, and I can refer you to the book that I did with agricultural economists, it both decreases farm productivity once you incorporate the environmental and health equations in kind of simultaneous models, such that if you could reduce the really hazardous pesticide use, you would both increase farm productivity and environmental sustainability. So there's been lots written. A really good reference globally is put together by Jules Pretty from the Institute for Environment and Development that David Satterthwaite also works at, although Jules has moved on. It's called the Pesticide Detox. The picture is one we took when we were showing farmers how pesticide residues persist on their hands even after they think they've washed with cold water. It doesn't actually remove them, and they continue to absorb them. On the right, you have some of our responses. Somebody, a woman talking about different kinds of pesticides. The colors of toxicity are in her poster she has on the right, so the red is the most hazardous down to green. Here is one of a person going and speaking to a person selling, a vendor of pesticides, checking what she understands, etc. And here is a farmer field school where farmers learn about ecology and various kinds of pests and ways of controlling pests that don't involve pesticides. So this generates a number of family farm health issues, but we must not forget the other ones, like backbreaking labor. And the other thing I want to focus on here is the dietary stuff. So a lot of farmers, if they're on the cusp of they're only producing enough on a small plot, they're mostly selling to market, they'll sell their higher value vegetables and their small animal eggs and milk if they're in urban settings, and they'll buy pasta. Foods that require less cooking are cheaper and which fill their kids up faster. And so part of what we see is throughout Latin America and the Andes, we see child malnutrition, social inequality gradients. We see food security challenges because people are tied into the market rather than still producing a lot of their own food. And we see very low diversity with very few fruits and vegetables. Colleagues at the Institute for Investigation and Nutrition in Peru have shown that. In terms of pesticides, we see a whole range of deaths from the top. This is per 10,000 rural population, our estimates, down to ongoing neurotoxicity. So the responses are something that was talked about earlier in terms of thinking about ecosystems, and there's a very good book coming out by IDRC colleagues, Dominique Charon has edited it, looking at ecosystems and human health approaches. It'll be out later this year, early next, from Springer. There's really good examples of making crop choices for both human nutrition as well as farm soil health and farm production. Rachel Besner-Kerr and colleagues in Malawi, and emphasizing vegetable production. In terms of reducing the bads, we've done work where we can improve knowledge and practices. Yeah, I'm going to go over time, sorry. But what we find is when we actually look at neurobehavioral function, which is a sensitive indicator of both education and learning, but also pesticide exposure, the poorer communities are the most disadvantaged, and the poorer households are the most disadvantaged. So even if you have a great health promotion, multi-stakeholder, multiple intervention kind of approach, the poor still don't change as much and still remain worse off. So it's a real challenge. Two positive examples on the bottom, an organic vegetable market that women have in Pichero, and a woman in Huancayo who is now incorporating way more vegetables into her family's food. So you can make change, and it's always important to remember that. Market influences are huge. You can read about some of them there. I think this vulnerability and the challenge about how do you move farmers into more organic, safer production, get them out of this low equilibrium poverty trap, what are the social supports that are needed, is a real issue. And we could get quite discouraged. Here's a woman producer of organic cabbage in the Huancayo or Montaro Valley. She's making it. It's working, but it's not growing a lot. Okay, it's not catching on among other farmers, and because the economics still aren't really there. On the right, we see a store that Women's Farm Association has got in Ambato, a local city, where they're tapping a middle and upper class market who can pay the premium for organic produce, and are making a go of it. We think eventually that they may be able to move to be self-supporting. I point down here broadly alternative and fair trade approaches and thinking about value chains for nutrition. Some of the International Food Policy and Research Institute work is really key here. Finally, appropriate governance. Heard lots about governance. We have done a fair bit of work around governance in sub-Saharan Africa. I refer you to this book on African urban harvest. Gordon Prain and colleagues have worked on. I think we're going to hear a bit about it in Montreal. The Andes are a real challenge. There's a history under the form of colonialism and of government of centralization and racism. And that's been hard to kind of keep working at. Ecuador is probably the best example where they're really struggling with that, and that's partly with the support of the indigenous movement and a new constitutional process whereby participation and social accountability are a key pillar of their, they sort of have the judiciary, the executive, the legislative branch, and then you have this participation and social accountability pillar of their constitution. And that's been really important in the Pijaro municipality and Tungurahua region, but also in Karchi in the north, where we work with platforms of stakeholders. You can see an example of a meeting on the right there. And try to talk about farmers' rights to information, to alternative ways of support for production, to alternative markets, etc. So I think that's a key sort of context in which some of the technical solutions can be applied. And just a picture of our Hortizana team.